6 months ago today, Governor Baker took to the podium on Beacon Hill, and without 6 feet of distance between him and his staff, he said this.
Today, I'm declaring a state of emergency in Massachusetts. This declaration will give our administration more flexibility to respond to this evolving outbreak. Responding to this evolving health threat requires everyone to be vigilant and for everyone to be part of this effort.
Today, we're 6 months into that declaration, and while the virus is spiking in 13 communities across the Commonwealth, overall, we have a positive infection rate below 0.9%. We have lost more than 9,000 of our neighbors, families, friends, coworkers to this disease, almost 200,000 people nationally. We have the highest unemployment rate in the nation, as thousands have lost their jobs in the wake of the shutdowns. So as we enter the next 6 months of our response to this pandemic, we have questions, and we assume you do too. So let's check in with two of our regular infectious disease doctors to ask where we've been, where we go from here, and to try to answer any of your new or lingering questions about the virus itself. This is a doctor call-in. Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to take those questions is Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Doron.
Great to be back.
And also with us is Dr. Sandra Nelson, an infectious disease physician at Mass General Hospital and assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Nelson, welcome back to you too.
Thanks so much.
So I just, in reading those numbers again, it's a lot. So let me just start by asking both of you, 6 months into this state of emergency, how are you and how do you think we're doing? Dr. Doron, maybe you can start.
Oh, how am I? It's tiring, and we're all tired. Everyone's tired. Everyone has pandemic fatigue. We in infectious disease and hospital epidemiology have been working so many hours, and we really are so sad about all the lives that we lost. But at the same time, here in Massachusetts, we do have to remember that we're lucky and that there's certainly a lot of hope given our low numbers.
May I ask you, have you lost anyone close to you?
No one very close to me.
I'm glad for you about that. Dr. Nelson, how about you? How are you doing?
I share some of those thoughts. It really is staggering when you think about it. 6 months is an incredibly long time in the life of this epidemic, but it's a short time in our own lives, and yet it feels like it's just been we've been living in this COVID world now for such a long time. I think one of the things that's so interesting is that that my day job is so much different than it used to be. I still see patients. I still do many of the things that we used to do, but it's just got such a different feel to it. There is both, I think, a sense of purpose and a sense of drive to do all that we can to help the people who are affected by this and to help our communities as they struggle to cope.
I feel like I regularly come across people who have different stories of when they realized how heavy this was, how long it was going to be with us, how real it was. I think for me, it was covering Governor Baker's presser the day that he said masks were going to be the new normal. When did each of you understand the depth and the breadth of what we were confronting?
I think that when I started to see that we were inevitably headed into a surge, maybe that was mid-March, maybe that was around the time the kids were released from school, that it occurred to me that this really was the new normal. This was not going away. We could get control over it, but it was going to change our lives irreparably for, quite some time.
I think for me, it was during the surge in Italy. And I think at the time that Italy was really in its crisis phase, we had an understanding that our cases were beginning to arise and that we were likely going to see a surge similar to what they had seen. And it was frightening thinking about what Italy was going through with inability to provide care for all the people who were sick. And I think that was when there was just this sense of dawning that our world was going to rapidly change within about a month.
So there is this tension now, and I say now, but it's been there all along, between balancing public health, economic health, mental health. Looking back on the last 6 months here in the Commonwealth, do you think we got that balance right? I'd love to hear from both of you.
You know, I think that answer will come in the future when we look back on this. Did we do enough? Did we do too much? Or it might never come. I mean, obviously, you can never know what would have happened if you had done things differently. I'm proud of the way our state and the way the Baker administration handled what was given to us, which was, you know, a situation where the disease had spread unrecognized for too long to avoid a surge and to avoid, you know, essentially nearly overwhelmed healthcare, a nearly overwhelmed healthcare system. And because we were in that state of being nearly overwhelmed, or, you know, some might say overwhelmed, we had to be extremely aggressive. And it worked. I mean, you know, there's no way to know if we did too much, but it worked. We did bring those numbers down to where they are right now, which is a very manageable level, at least from a healthcare standpoint.
Dr. Nelson, do you agree?
I do agree. I think that, you know, especially early on when there really was a lack of certainty around the direction that this was going to go, any decision that was made was going to be fraught with you know, anxiety. Either it's going to be too much, it's going to be too little. But I do think that there was a respect for science, and that drove a lot of the decision making. And especially understanding even that even the science isn't perfect, and that there was still a lot of unknowns. But nonetheless, there was a respect for the epidemiology. There was a respect for what we understood in terms of public health. And I think the leadership in our state, not only did they make decisions around this, but they also emphasized the importance for public health so that the individuals in the state, the residents of the Commonwealth, I think also listened to the scientific council. And I do think that relative to other states, we have done a much better job. I think moving forward, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And I think the challenge is going to be balancing the public health while also trying to create a path forward, knowing that this may be some time.
All right, let's go to the phones. And this is a call in for you, listeners. What questions, lingering or new, do you have about the virus, about how we're handling it, about what comes next, maybe about vaccines or how we, what we know about infection now? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm going to turn to Nick from Jamaica Plain. Nick, you are on with the doctors.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm curious for the doctors, what is our hope for containment of this of these infections? With the new news, with Bob, just really, I'm frustrated because we could have contained it, and now I want to know what the doctors think in terms of containment of the virus. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Dr. Durone.
Well, I mean, I guess it really depends on what you mean by containment. You know, at what point is the virus contained? And, you know, I would say that we're in an amazing place right now compared to where we started. I think that, you know, we probably didn't expect that with reopening of businesses and workplaces and the economy, we could actually continue to see case rates go down and down and down and down. So, you know, that what that has taught us is how much masking and distancing and hand hygiene and all of those things really, really work. And so what it has also taught us is if we continue to do that, we can continue to see improvement. Now, what the effect of cold weather will have, you know, is another thing that remains to be seen. But, you know, we're doing it. We are containing it.
And Dr. Nelson, if we had complete compliance on masking, social distancing, hand washing, the things Dr. Durone just talked about, could we be more reopened than we are?
I think that if we had complete, and I think by complete, we would have to consider not just Massachusetts, but really a wider circle, or really almost worldwide adherence. If everybody masked at all times, this epidemic would end. And so, of course, if the epidemic ended, we would be able to open up society in a much faster way. It wouldn't be immediate. It would take time. Masks are not 100% effective. But if we all masked at all times, then the transmission cycle would slow down enough that there, the numbers of cases would go down over time until it really dwindled.
Let's go to another call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Olina on the line from Andover. Olina, welcome to the show. What's your question for the doctors?
Hello, everyone, and I hope you can hear me well. And I have two questions. One question relates to the current treatment that I use to treat COVID-19 disease. And second question, I'm interested about remdesivir, the drug available from Gilead. And I'm wondering when that particular drug will be applied at massive scale so people with mild symptoms can receive that dose and basically don't be afraid to go outside.
Thank you, Olina. So the two questions are, what are the current treatments that are considered best practice, and what is the status of the availability of remdesivir, especially for people who are not symptomatic, is what I think she was asking there at the end. Dr. Nelson, do you want to go first, or Dr. Drone? I'm fine with either one.
Sure, I'm happy to answer that. So there really are two treatments that have shown effectiveness in treating severe COVID, or I should say moderate to severe COVID. And that includes one, the treatment that was mentioned, remdesivir, which is an antiviral treatment. And then the other is corticosteroid therapy, and particularly dexamethasone, which is an anti-inflammatory, which is shown to be helpful really later in the disease. The challenge that I think that the caller was asking is that we don't currently have a treatment for mild disease, and neither remdesivir nor dexamethasone have been shown to be helpful during mild disease. So there really isn't a plan right now for that. There are some other potential treatments that are in the works that are still undergoing analysis that may be more useful in early studies. Monoclonal antibodies, for one, may show some promise in this area, but I think it's going to be some time before we have that. The availability of remdesivir has improved, but it is still a limitation in some settings. And I think that is something that we may struggle with again as we, if and when we surge in the fall.
Let's go to Anne now, 800-423-8255. We've got Anne on the line from Roslindale. Hi, Anne, you're on with our doctors.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I had COVID-19 at the end of March and early April, and I've donated my plasma once, but there's a increased push now for me to do that more frequently. I was initially told every 28 days, now I'm told every once a week. And I'm just wondering how effective convalescent plasma is.
So, Anne, I'm going to give you to Dr. Drone in a second to answer that question. But before we do, how are you?
I'm fine. I feel like I'm fully recovered. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm glad to hear it. All right, Dr. Drone, so convalescent plasma.
I'm glad to hear it, too. And I'll definitely let Dr. Nelson comment as well, since she's more in the trenches with the treatment. But this convalescent plasma has been a topic of much controversy, as you know, with some saying that the FDA emergency use authorization was not warranted, and others saying that it very much is. And so, the question is really sort of the at this point, is the robustness of the data, and did that warrant that FDA approval? And should it be given as only as part of a clinical trial, which is what the Infectious Disease Society recommends, with a placebo arm, so that you are able to compare it to no therapy at all? Or is there enough information now to give it just as part of clinical care? And I'm interested to hear what Dr. Nelson thinks about that.
Well, I think you said that perfectly. I think that the science really around convalescent plasma is not settled, and we do need more study. Right now, I think the only use for it, at least in my hospital, is in the setting of a clinical trial. There have been only two prospective studies that directly compared convalescent plasma to no convalescent plasma. And these two studies didn't actually show a difference in treatment outcomes. And interestingly, one of the studies actually was stopped early. This was done in the Netherlands because the recipients already had high antibody levels, which suggested that the transfusions weren't going to be necessary. And I think if convalescent plasma were perfectly safe, this may not be an important issue. But because there are some risks associated with it, I think we all think that we really need a little bit more study before this enters any widespread use.
So I'm hearing some real notes of caution from the two of you. And I'll just loop back around to the end, or the part of Anne's question too, which is, would it under those circumstances be valuable for Anne to be donating more frequently than she currently is?
To the extent that there is a limited population of individuals who are able to provide the plasma, and given that we really do need more answers, the clinical studies are still ongoing, I do think it would be helpful if it's something that wouldn't inconvenience her.
Thanks for that. Let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. Ryan, you are on. Ryan from Framingham, what's your question?
Hi, thank you very much, everybody, first of all, for taking my call. I have a little girl. She's 9 years old, going back to school. And, I can honestly say I'm completely overwhelmed by what they're putting on our plate. But I was just hoping for some tips on, how I bring that daughter into school surrounded by who knows what. And I try to explain to her how, we're in a pandemic. And it seems as though by the, dictionary definition, the numbers don't anywhere near qualify us for being in a pandemic.
So, Ryan, let me just ask one more question. Is your daughter going into the school building for hybrid learning? Is she going to be there full time?
Yeah, she'll be there hybrid. She's going to be 2 days on, and of course her 2 days off are both of my visitation days, so I really scored with that one.
Perfect. All right, thanks for that, Ryan. And we'll turn to the doctors now. Dr. Derone.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, this is just really one of the most tragic parts of the pandemic because it's so important for our children to be in school for so many reasons. And it is so scary for parents, for teachers, for administrators, and for children. And there are a few things, that can help prepare children to be in that kind of setting. And a lot of people say that it's really helpful to have children practicing wearing masks, at home, going out and about with their families, because practice does make perfect, and, getting used to wearing a mask is so important. What we don't want to have is teachers too distracted with keeping their students' masks on rather than teaching. Some children may be scared, and it's important to remind them that the risk is low, but that we want to keep them safe. And hand hygiene can go a long way, along with, of course, remembering that distance from their classmates and, what is 6 feet? That can be hard for a kid. We usually say that if you reach out your arm and your neighbor reaches out their arm and you both can't touch each other, that's probably enough. On a little arm, that might not be 6 feet, but it's a good guideline to start with.
Let's go to Sam now, 800-423-8255, to ask your questions of Drs. Derone and Nelson. Sam is in Brewster. Hi, Sam, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. My wife and I are considering babysitting 1 day a week for our 15-month-old granddaughter. We are trying to assess how much risk we are taking, and as part of that, I was wondering what the evidence on transmissibility of COVID-19 from children is to adults.
Thanks, Sam. Who'd like that one?
I'm happy to address that. I think, the COVID-19 is a respiratory virus. And if we think about the models for other respiratory viruses, it would make sense that children would be important in terms of vectors for transmission. But interestingly, the early portion of this epidemic didn't find that to be the case, that children really didn't transmit very much in schools or in their households. There were a lot of concerns early on about how we were interpreting that data. It was that only because children were less likely to be infected. We had taken them out of their school settings, so they really weren't able to demonstrate their propensity to infect. But I think that we've learned a little bit more since. There was a large study from Korea that was published in July that looked at the rates that children were able to transmit. There was initially some thought that older children transmitted as effectively as adults. That has since actually been revisited, and that actually assumption may not be holding true anymore. But what has been seen in particular is that younger children, including those in the 15-month age range, are actually not very likely to transmit. We don't fully understand why this is, and I would also I would also caution that I think that the data is not complete, and we probably won't know the real answer to this in a long time. But I think really where things stand right now, you could feel somewhat assured. I think that the data suggests that you would probably be greater risk to the child than vice versa.
I'm hoping to get a couple more calls in. We've got Casey from Cambridge on the line. Casey, what's your question?
Hi, yeah, thank you so much. I'm curious, there's a growing population of folks who have recovered from COVID, and those who were confirmed tested and others who suspect that they had it. And would love to hear your thoughts on cases for immunity for recovered patients.
Thanks, Casey. Dr. Derone, can you field that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand the question. Is the question about whether people who have recovered are immune to reinfection?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so that's a tricky one. So we believe that people who have confirmed COVID-19, now, you know, a lot of people think they had it because they had some kind of symptoms during the winter and didn't have access to a test or didn't get tested. And, you know, I would say that they're probably as likely to have had something else as they were to have had COVID-19. But people with confirmed infection using a PCR test are probably immune for some period of time, or they're definitely immune for some period of time, because we've been in this pandemic for quite a few months now, and we've seen very few convincing cases of reinfection. Now, what we do see is people who might or might not get symptoms again, or might or might not get tested again and have positive tests again, and that's not the same thing, because we know that people have positive tests and negative tests over time, and that doesn't necessarily represent live new virus. But now we've had in the last couple of weeks some reports of people who are tested again, some didn't have symptoms again, and somebody sequenced the virus, really looking at the genetic makeup of the virus, and really was able to document that it was different. So that's more convincing that there may be some reinfections. And those have generally been late. They're generally more than 90 days after the original infection, although one was less. And that's why the CDC says that people should pretty much not be retested again within 90 days of their original infection. And then if they have symptoms again after that, you could consider testing them again and potentially isolating them if they're positive and contact tracing their contacts after evaluation you think it could be a reinfection.
So we're short on time now. I'm not going to be able to take any more calls. I'm sorry to the callers who are still on the line. We will do this again. We will give you another chance to call in and ask these questions of a panel of really knowledgeable and thoughtful doctors. In this last little bit of time we have, I do want to take a moment to think with the two of you, Drs. Derone and Nelson, about not only where we've been in this pandemic, but where we're going. And I want to ask you each, how does this end? What does the end mean and look like for this pandemic? Dr. Nelson.
You know, I think the most important thing to stress right now is really one of patience. I think we are all facing some pandemic fatigue, but realistically, when we think about this ending, we may really be talking about years for sort of an ending and back to a stage that we would call something like normal. I do think the vaccine is going to play an important role. I don't know when one will be available, but we're optimistic that we might have one early next year. But even with that, there's going to be some time spent in getting it distributed. And from that point, there will also be some time for that immunity to really become sufficient to drive the pandemic down. So patience, and really stick with the public health mitigation measures that we really know to be effective in the meantime.
Dr. Derone, we've got a little bit less than a minute. How about you?
I agree fully. And, you know, it's not going to end with a light switch that's turned off. There will eventually be a vaccine. The cases will continue even when the vaccine is being deployed. We will still have to do masking and distancing in the face of a vaccine. And then eventually, hopefully, it will peter out and we will declare it over.
Well, I am grateful to both of you on behalf of our listeners for taking this time to answer questions. That's Dr. Shira Derone, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Derone, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sandra Nelson, an infectious disease physician at Mass General Hospital and an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thanks to you as well, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow marks the 19th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and we're going to play some sound for you from that day. And as a warning, although I don't think you'll be surprised, that sound is hard to listen to. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, on ABC's Good Morning America, host Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer were getting a report of what was happening at the World Trade Center.
As fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
And then their reaction that followed reflects how the nation was feeling that day.
Oh, this is terrifying. Awful.
To watch powerless is a horror.
That day, that tragedy was incomprehensible. And I don't know about you, but I find that sound in this moment very difficult to listen to. Now, 19 years later, we are facing another national crisis. It's a pandemic that has caused almost 200,000 deaths in the United States. And we find ourselves thinking about each tragedy in the context of the other. And we wanted to have a conversation about that. And joining us to do that is just the right person. Mitch Zukov, professor in narrative studies at Boston University and author of Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Mitch.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And listeners, we invite your calls too. How are you reflecting on this 19th anniversary of September 11th in the midst of another national crisis? What is similar or different about these two crises and our responses to them, especially as we near 200,000 deaths nationally from COVID-19. Is it hard to conceptualize those deaths in a way that the losses on the September 11th felt so immediate? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us on this one at Radio Boston. So, Mitch, I just want to start with what is on your mind as tomorrow's anniversary approaches?
Well, I think like everyone, we're in this sort of this, as you described, this incredible new crisis that's sort of unfolding more slowly, but just as all-consuming as 9/11 was for those of us who experienced it. As others have pointed out, you know, we're experiencing now a 9/11 level tragedy every 3 days, with 3,000 deaths every 3 days in this COVID crisis. And so I'm thinking, I think as you are, and I think a lot of people are, what is this going to mean for the national character? What is it going to mean for who we are as a people, who we are as a community, who we are as a country? And I think sadly and tragically even, I think we have to conclude that we are a much different people, or reacting differently at least, than we did in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
So Mitch, I want to ask about that because of course there must be something in that that's true, but at the same time, how do we get our minds around the slow-moving crisis and tragedy we're in now? There was something so profound and immediate and shocking and unexpected about that day. This is just different. And aren't we built so that we would process these things differently?
I think that's exactly what's happening, that we would, and it's really, it's great and powerful that you did the Good Morning America in the lead in here. We all witnessed it. We were all witnesses to what was happening. And it was on an endless loop in our eyes, in our ears, in the immediate aftermath. And so we were almost sort of programmed as humans to have this fight or flight response. And we knew what we were supposed to do because we could see it in front of us. When you have, as the president likes to say, an invisible enemy like a virus that unfolds slowly, that doesn't, doesn't have flames in the sky, we are not quite sure how to react to it, even though I think, intellectually, we can understand that these are both existential threats, but they take different forms, so we are reacting differently.
And listeners, we're talking to Mitch Zukov, professor in narrative studies at Boston University, about the anniversary of September 11th, which is tomorrow, and how we process that in the context of another national crisis. If you'd like to share your reflections, you can join us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Mitch, I know you have remarked on the unity of 2001 and the disunity of this moment. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, if you think about it, first, in terms of the absence of partisanship after 9/11, you know, on September 14th, Congress voted, first the Senate voted 98-0, and then the House voted 420-1 with one opponent to basically give George Bush and the Republican in power unending power, to unending authority, to do whatever was needed to hunt down the people who were responsible for this. And Barbara Lee, the one who objected, a California congresswoman, was just worried about the blank check idea, which obviously proved prescient in terms of what happened in Iraq. But essentially, everyone was behind this. Everyone sort of lined up and said, this is no time for us to point fingers at whether the Republicans in power had kept us safe or whether there was an intelligence failure or what have you. Everyone came together, I think. And I think those of us who lived through it experienced it. And so there was this moment of national unity, and more than a moment, it lasted a while. I think we all know that we have not seen a moment of national unity here. We've seen a tremendous disunity, disagreements over the science, disagreements over whether wearing a mask was an act of partisan, approval for one side or the other. And so I think that has been an incredibly stark difference. And frankly, for someone who's studied 9/11 and is living through COVID, deeply disappointing.
Mitch, I'd love to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We have Lauren on the line from Somerville. How are you reflecting, Lauren?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm finding this a new instance, a new thing to be in. I was 11 years old, and I had just started at a new school, and we were all kind of herded into a cafeteria, and we had that air of not knowing what was going on, being excited, and we didn't know what was going on. We thought it was, like, bad, but we were in it together, and it was unknown, and it was kind of, like, maybe exciting. And then later we learned from our parents just how bad it was. And now, being a mental health professional as an adult, seeing this pandemic and seeing these out, like, where have all my friends gone? And what is happening right now? It's fascinating to be in a generational trauma, as it were, it seems to be, at least.
Thanks for that, Lauren. And Mitch, I heard you when Lauren said now an adult and a mental health professional, I heard you respond to that. So maybe I can let you react there.
Well, I think Lauren's really onto something in terms of the idea that when we experienced 9/11, we were able to do it as a herd, in the sense. We gathered together, we huddled together, whether it was in classrooms or in our offices or in our homes, and we were all connected in that way. We were all experiencing it together, even if it was via media. But now we're incredibly disconnected by design, obviously, to prevent the virus from spreading further. But I think that there's a feeling of isolation as this is happening. And I think as a mental health professional, Lauren is sort of doing a really interesting job of linking those two in terms of how we as humans are reacting differently to these two events.
I'd like to bring another caller in here, Mitch. We have Andrew on the line from West Roxbury. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question about what Mitch thought about the impact that this, I guess we can call it, prolonged mass casualty incident like COVID-19 lasting multiple months has had versus a singular mass casualty incident like 9/11.
Thanks for that. Andrew, Mitch, what are you thinking?
It's a great question, Andrew. I think it remains to be seen, frankly, just how deeply it cuts. Because frankly, I would have thought 200,000 deaths or whatever the number is would make it clear to everyone just how we are all affected by this. But it does seem to be a disjointed effect where we all could identify with the 3,000 dead in 9/11. And for some reason, by a factor of almost 70 times as many people, we are not. So I think it would be premature for me to say how it's going to affect us long term. But it bears study.
You know, Mitch, I remember early on in covering the pandemic, we did a segment where we were getting calls from all over the place by people who were benefiting from or participating in mutual aid societies, neighbors coming together to help neighbors, to support each other. We haven't done another segment on that, so I don't know if we would still be getting those calls now. But there was, I think, a sense that we were in this together and had solidarity and we're going to need to solve problems together. Do you think we've lost that in the arc of these last 6 to 8 months, depending on where you as an individual count the beginning?
You know, I'm an optimist by nature. And we all remember in the beginning of this, and just what you're talking about, the mutual aid, I thought there was a real parallel between, you know, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, you could not go near a fire station in New York without sort of encountering people delivering cakes and coming to say thank you to the firefighters. And we experienced that here with the COVID crisis, where we had the 7 p.m. people leaning out their windows to thank the healthcare workers and to clap for them as they change shifts. And yet now I do feel that has started to go away. People have started to move back into their own lives and their own concerns. So I fear that we are losing it a bit, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry, I had five thoughts crash into my head at once after listening to you, because there's so much here. I think the first one that I will comb out is the fact that there was something about the attack on September 11th that we understood as an attack on our union. Yes. And early on in the experience of the virus, and I think maybe even arguably today, we had a very much a philosophy that this was happening to states and individuals in states. And I mean, I remember Governor Baker's frustration in those early press conferences trying to get PPE and asking the federal government to help. Did that state by state problem solving and the need to do state by state problem solving and emphasis on it change our sense of shared experience as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As soon as we were sort of divided into states, that there were blue states and red states, and there were hot spots and other. As soon as that happened, it gave the virus a footing. It's almost like it was sort of serving the enemy. After 9/11, we understood the face of this enemy, and by 9:30 that morning, the CIA understood this was Al Qaeda. And we all collectively understood it was an attack on all of us, even though it was an East Coast event, even though, I mean, you talk to anyone across this country, people felt as deeply personal about it as anyone, you know, as you can imagine. But you're right. As soon as there was, and let's face it, it happened from Washington. There was this feeling that governors had to figure it out on their own, you know, how to ask a Bob Kraft to get Chinese PPE to get enough, you know, N95s or KN95s.
That's the owner of the New England Patriots who used their private jet. No, just for context for listeners, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, we people were, you know, sort of governors were talking about competing against other governors. I mean, the idea of that they were having to compete with other governors for whether it was ventilators or PPE or what have you, that immediately made it every man or every woman for herself. And that completely undermined any possibility of a sort of a national response to this crisis.
So I'm just going to bring in one more voice. We got a tweet from Katie Gairdon. Katie, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, saying, I'm not trying to be flippant, but in light of all we're doing going through now, 9/11 seems quaint. It's amazing how desensitized we are now to the staggering loss of life. What are the rituals or approaches, and Mitch, we've got only a couple of minutes, that we can be using to share this sense of weight and experience with each other? We've talked a lot about the disconnect. How can we reconnect?
I think it is part of the job, and I understand. I don't take Katie's comment as flip. I think it's true. It's this sort of the concept of, you know, you boil a frog, if you throw it in hot water, which is what happened to 9/11, it jumps out because it reacts. But this slowly boiling, this slow boiling we've all experienced, it's normalizing, or it's conditioning us to this. I think it's our job in the media to do a better job and do more of what we were doing initially in telling the stories of the losses, of highlighting how, you know, how the webs of family are being unwound as each empty person, empty seat at every dinner table. We have to drive that home, and we have to connect everyone to the idea that 200,000 dead is not a number. And it is, you know, it is 200,000 times 100 tragedies of every person who those lives touch.
Mitch, I really appreciate it. That's Mitch Zuckoff, professor in narrative studies at Boston University and author of Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. Thank you so much, Mitch.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Welcome to Boston Logan International Airport.
In the bowels of Logan Airport, tucked away in baggage claim, there's a small chapel. It's called Our Lady of the Airways, and it's the first airport chapel ever built in the U.S. We're taking you there today as the second installment of our series on Boston's hidden sacred spaces, a project mapping these little-known places of worship through radio and interactive 3D models you can explore on your computer or smartphone. Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman was there earlier this year, and he brings us back to this tiny Catholic chapel weathering the changing times.
Our Lady of the Airways is not easy to find.
Can I bother you for a second? Do you know where the chapel is?
Yes. Go back here and take our right and just follow that maybe eighth of a mile
back,
or so.
Back, right, walk.
Yeah, just walk and...
It's tucked away near baggage claim in between terminals B and C. But once you're inside, it's a world apart from Logan Airport.
Reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Glory to you, O Lord.
That's Father Richard Uftring, the priest of Our Lady of the Airways. On this January Sunday, he's celebrating Mass with a few dozen people.
Jesus heard that John had been arrested.
The rectangular chapel is dimly lit with red brick walls. There's a custom-made statue of the Virgin Mary in front of the altar. She stands on a globe circled by three airplanes. Father Uftring stands in the aisle to be closer to the parishioners in the pews. Some are travelers, others are regulars, like Ann Foster. She lives nearby in Peabody and was married at Our Lady of the Airways about 35 years ago. She says she makes a point to come as often as possible.
I stay in Peabody occasionally. I float back and forth, but when I really need to feel like I've been to really, I like it down here. It's much more personal.
John Varengia of Revere has been coming for 10 years. He used to come here with his father.
I have a lot of great memories here. My dad passed away 6 years ago, and late in the game, he decided to return to his faith. Matter of fact, where you sit in front, there's a little plaque right in front where you were sitting that has his name on it. We came for the last 16 months of his life every single week, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. In fact, right up until the week before he died.
But these parishioners say the masses here aren't as well attended as they used to be. Father Uftring sees it too.
You know, people come now, get dropped off at the airport. They think right away they got to get through security. They got to get to it. It's stressful flying right now. Mm-hmm. And so people get here. They don't have time to mull around. There was used to be shopping. There used to be restaurants. All of those are phased out because people just want to get in and get to their plane.
In many ways, Our Lady of the Airways is a relic of an older Boston, and one that exists because of one person.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, amen. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator...
Richard Cardinal Cushing was the Archbishop of Boston from 1944 to 1970. In those three decades, he forever transformed the region, leading a massive expansion of parishes and churches.
And so it was very much a part of his larger program to bring the church to where the people were. And that might mean new suburban towns that were growing, but it might also mean the airport, where people were now traveling increasingly.
That's James O'Toole, a scholar of American Catholic history at Boston College. He says Cardinal Cushing built Our Lady of the Airways in 1951 as part of his mission to establish workmen's chapels around the city, so the working class could more easily go to Mass, and all the priests coming home after World War II could have jobs.
The population of Catholic priests in Boston and in the country as a whole was growing very rapidly in the aftermath of the war. You could see it as a kind of supply and demand sort of dynamic, I suppose, and the airport chapel would have been a part of that.
Behind the scenes, Cushing pulled the levers of state government to get a chapel put into the airport, and got the space essentially for free. The rent was $100 a year. Our Lady of the Airways was so well attended in its early years, it outgrew its original location. The Archdiocese had it relocated and expanded in 1965 to where it remains today. But these are different times. The share of the population identifying as Catholic in the United States has steadily decreased as the country's religious landscape changes and the church continues to reckon with its sexual abuse crisis. The Boston Archdiocese is closing churches and consolidating parishes. O'Toole says the church is now dealing with the opposite kind of supply and demand problem it had after World War II. Priests are dying and retiring faster than new ones are ordained.
And the priests who remain are, as the sociologists say, graying. So the church won't be able to support the same extensive infrastructure of institutions that it did in the past. And we see this already.
Talking to the parishioners who attend regular Sunday Masses at Our Lady of the Airways, they say it's their priest, Father Uftring, who holds them together. Here's Mary Grace Gravelisi Festa, the creative director of Massport.
I got hooked on him. I did, yeah. I think if he wasn't here and I knew he was somewhere else, I would go where he was.
But when the pandemic ends, Father Uftring won't be back at Our Lady of the Airways. He retired in July after serving 24 years as the chapel's priest. The future of Our Lady of the Airways isn't clear, but for parishioners and travelers from around the world who stumble across this church, it remains their own hidden sacred space.
And that is Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman. To explore an interactive 3D model of Our Lady of the Airways, go to our website, radioboston.org, and join us next week for our final installment of the series on Boston's hidden sacred spaces. We're going to visit a synagogue inside a senior home in Roslindale where the residents sing Bob Marley. That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.